Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this panel forum that we have. This is the first time I think that we've run something like this as part of our annual meeting. And I think this is something which, judging from the response we've already had, even before our speakers have spoken, could well be something that we'll revisit. I'm Sean Lang, I'm the Honorary Secretary of the Association, and it's a very great pleasure for me to be chairing this discussion on the question of exactly why it is that history matters. We've put in the programme, as you'll see, the idea that we assume an understanding of history is vital. Well, I suppose we wouldn't be, the Historical Association, but is it? It's often the way, I think, that when people want to cite useless knowledge, they nearly always use historical examples. Usually, in fact, they're Hastings, actually. They used to say, I might know about Hastings in 1066, but it doesn't really matter. And it is a reminder that what seems obvious to us is not necessarily obvious about the importance of history to others. History is popular, we know that. We know the number of history programmes there are on television and radio, and the number of history books being sold. But what sort of history is it that the public is actually getting, or indeed that the public actually wants? Is history, in fact, just a branch of entertainment? When people do raise objections to anomalies or errors in Hollywood films, we're very often called pedants or purists and dismissed and put back into our box. So in order to address this question of not just does history matter, but exactly why, and in what sense is history vital and important for our society? Are we simply a very interesting leisure pursuit, or are we actually central to the needs of our society and indeed the needs of our citizens? To discuss this issue, and with a particular emphasis upon the idea of the uses of history, we have a very distinguished panel up here. Sakitha Jedbo, to my left, former head teacher and Home Office advisor, was also the chair of the group which produced the highly influential report on diversity and citizenship in schools, and who proposed the idea of a fourth strand citizenship, very much to reintroduce something which it had been thought was going to be central to citizenship education, that is, an understanding of history and of the wider perspective in terms of time, that is the mark, I suppose, of an informed citizen. I do remember, you wouldn't know this, Keith, but before citizenship was fully launched, but I was Christine Canton and I were meeting Nick Tate, who was then chief executive of the National Curriculum Council. And he said that no one knew quite what citizenship was going to be, but whatever it was, the history teachers would be teaching it. Well, just went to show how wrong one can be. Professor John Tosh is Professor of History at Roehampton University. There have been two main strands to his work. On the one hand, he's a historian of gender and particularly of masculinity in Victorian times, but he's also developed a very impressive second strand about history, its nature, its pursuit, and its importance. And if you haven't already, I would very strongly recommend his most recent book, Why History Matters. Indeed, you might think that having read that, you need hardly stay for the afternoon. In there he points to the reservations that there are in the history world, particularly in the academic history world, about the application of history to the modern world. He looks at the growth of citizenship and at the importance of historical awareness in society and in the citizens within it. Claire Fox, to my right, illustrates this point, I think, perfectly. She grew up in a Catholic family from Ireland, but in Manchester and Wales, I think I'm often saying. And turned to Marxism and was the editor of Living Marxism, which she rebranded and very much, I think, relaunched as LM and to some extent turned its fortunes round. But then 20 years ago, she... 20 years?
10.
10 years ago, big one. She founded the Institute of Ideas, which, if you haven't encountered, I would very, very strongly recommend that you get onto the website and along to the meetings. I've spoken at a couple of the annual battles of ideas that the Institute holds in London. And I can really say that if your experience of debating and discussion has in any way been drab or brings back bad memories of sixth form, but debating societies get that. You seldom get such a buzz of excitement, of different ideas, of the sort of free interplay of very, very different angles and perspectives that come in. Not surprisingly, therefore, she's also a regular on the Moral Maze and on Question Time, and she has the courage of her convictions to go against the flow and to champion unpopular causes. In fact, unusually, I think, for someone coming from the left, has actually been accused of being too far to the right. So we'll see how we go. Alison Kitson, Oxford graduate, teacher, member of the HA Secondary Committee and of the editorial team of Teaching History, a face and name which will be familiar to many people within the association and of course, therefore, to many people here. A regular writer in BBC History magazine on education, education matters, and worked for a time for the TDA, the Teaching Development Agency, in other words, the government body in charge of training and development, and now lecturer in education at the Institute of Education in London, and therefore brings that balance of the chalk face and the wider perspective and the knowledge of policy making to inform our debate still further. So, it is with very great pleasure that I call upon Keith Ajegbo to start our discussions.
Good afternoon. Hi, I'm neither a historian nor a citizenship teacher, in fact. I was an English teacher, so I always feel a bit of an imposter on these occasions. But the reason I'm talking to you is that as I was retiring as a head in 2006-2007, I was asked to write this report on diversity and citizenship. And the two questions that we were asked to report on, I think it was Ruth Kelly at the time, a long time ago, is how is ethnic, religious and cultural diversity addressed in the school curriculum? And should British modern social and cultural history be the fourth pillar of citizenship? So those are the two questions. And the reasons why I think we were asked at that particular time were because of 7/7 had just happened, the whole issue about terrorism and religion. Trevor Phillips had said we were sleepwalking to segregation. Issues around immigration and the BNP, and also all the issues about the white working class and alienation. So those were the things that we were asked to write about. And I think there was a sense of community in crisis, communities fragmenting, a sense of separateness between different communities in the country. And I've been born in 1946, and I've been born with, you know, the deeds that won the empire and Britain as the workshop of the world. That was a sort of understanding of Britishness that I suppose I'd grown up with as a child. And you get this sense, when doing this piece of work, of an older generation of white Britons remembering the 50s, of young working class white people in some areas feeling alienated. And then we had some quotes from BME, black and minority ethnic pupils, one saying, well, they, meaning us, you, everyone, they see Africa as poor, Asia as flooded, and England as snobby whites and poor blacks. And then another kid said, musing on his identity, I'm black, nothing about being British, I'm black, I live in London, that's my home, my parents are from the Caribbean, but I'm really African, I'm a Christian, but then he got really excited, but I'm E7. That's where E7's not that salubrious in Newham. That's where I hang out. They're my people. That's who I am. And so there was this whole issue, I think, about identity, and it made me then think about national identity, as we were asked to write about Britishness, and it then made me think about history in ways that perhaps I hadn't done before. And what I think I came to the conclusion, in my amateur way, in a sense, as not being a historian, is that history is vital to exploring a sense of national identity. And in the end, I decided that national identity is related to some aspects of our personal identity, that there is a relationship between personal identity and national identity. And it's also related to some aspects of how we see the people who live around us and about us. And that's why in the report, we suggested a fourth aspect of citizenship, which was identity and diversity. How do we live together in the UK, and that if you were going to teach good citizenship, that it had to be linked very, very closely to history, and that history was an important aspect of that bit of citizenship. I mean, obviously, as a separate subject as well. And I think that history and why it's important to young people and why it's essential that it is taught well and taught rigorously, that it enables us to explore national identity through looking at the values that Britain has committed itself to. Not, I mean, British values, but the ones that it has committed itself to. Those list of values that people think about when they think about Britain. And allows them to think about it in relation to aspects of recent British history. And that if you look at history from a number of different perspectives, so if you're Jewish or if you're Muslim or if you're African Caribbean, or if you're working class white. It enables that history to be inclusive. It enables it to incorporate personal history, the history of the children who might be in the class in front of you. And it enables you perhaps to reforge, to reformulate some sense of national identity that is inclusive, and that brings people together and has a core of people coming together at its centre. And I think the good history is really important to ensuring that every child matters, which is at the heart at the moment of education rhetoric. So what does it mean to be British? What does it mean to be Irish or Scottish or Welsh or Black British? Why should we or shouldn't we celebrate St George's Day? I think are interesting and important questions. What is the history of immigration? I mean, is it different being a sort of recent Polish migrant to being related to a Viking? I mean, what is the history of immigration? How does immigration relate to the legacy of empire? I mean, what is the relationship between immigration, empire, the people here, and how they feel about that bit of the past? And in a sense, how has the equalities agenda changed our world? So how important historically is it that when my uncle came to study, I'm half Nigerian, half English, came to study in England in the 50s, no coloureds, no Irish, no dogs, all the places he went to try and stay, and that wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen now. There's a whole history there that I think is interesting, exciting, and important to young people living in this country at this moment in time. I think that history can help all children to understand their context and their place in a bigger story. And it can help them recreate a sense of national identity in the face of an incredibly rapidly changing world. But it mustn't lie. It can't recreate some triumphal past that never really existed. It mustn't lie. And it must incorporate the histories of everybody. And I think that history is really important in helping young children and young people and students to deal with those really difficult questions and those controversial issues that our world throws up, and to be able to put some perspective on them, to have some rigour in terms of the debate, and to look at the why those questions have come to the point that they have come. I mean, in a book I think that was recently published by Civitas called Disunited Kingdom, I think it's just come out, someone called David Conway quotes in the book, which I think is the essence of this book, he quotes an American called Robert Bork, says that ethnic separatism and hostility to other ethnic groups may be inbred in mankind, requiring no explanation peculiar to any particular society. And those are the sorts of issues, those big questions, history can take on, and history can argue, and children who understand history can get into that debate. What is the history of race relationships? Why have people sought asylum? What is the relationship between the notion of Britishness and Islam? And history can play a really important part in looking at those things. And also, I think, to appreciate and admire a world, and admire, and I say admire a world, of absolutely increasing complexity, we need to understand connections from personal history to community to national history to Europe to the globe. These are the big links that will shape the future of many of our students' lives. And history is vital in making sense of all those complicated connections. But to finish, increasingly I think that history, to be relevant and vital, it has to work with other subjects across the curriculum. It needs to retain its integrity, but it requires, and it requires expertise to teach history, but it has to open itself up to working with citizenship, to working with geography, to working with English and right across the curriculum, if it is really going to help young people make sense of what is a difficult and challenging world. Thank you.
Thank you. John Tosh.
That awful thing, relevance. You remember the President saying that at the beginning of the day. It's a comment which was uttered half lightheartedly, but it's a comment which I think reflects a certain ambivalence on the part of historians to the idea that their subject might hold practical application. On the one hand, historians are happy to give a general endorsement of that history matters, which is a sentiment that I'm sure we all agree with. But they then tend to be very cagey about applying that with any precision. And the word relevance seems to be the sticking point, or for some, the red rag in front of the bull. Now, I'm going to talk for a few minutes not about the school curriculum, about which Sir Keith has just been very eloquent, but to put history in a broader frame of social relevance and social responsibility. And first of all, I want to observe that there are two hardy perennials in terms of defining what history's social role is, which we find partly represented amongst our own ranks and represented even more in the media. First of all, history matters because it is a hugely expensive and highly profitable industry, an industry that works through the institutions of heritage and the media. A history which, whatever its positive side effects and byproducts, is to do fundamentally with entertainment, and indeed in a great many cases, perhaps the majority, with visual entertainment, that's to say, visual stimulus. And the problem, I think, that many historians feel with the label heritage and the apparent danger that our subject may be, as it were, subsumed within heritage, is it seems to place at a discount the critical understanding of history and the role of history as a means to critique the world around us, because that's not what usually heritage is about. The second answer that is conventionally given to the question why history matters is that it is a vital means of social cohesion, which is what Sir Keith was really talking about, I think. But it is, if you like, a rhetorical reinforcement of certain political values that we hold dear, and in certain cases, specific political loyalties. And this way of thinking about the practical application of history is, of course, as old as history itself. In the last generation, the generation of the teachers who taught us before last, as it were, it was a concept that was gravely discredited by its association with totalitarianism. And, for example, in the 50s and 60s, most comments by historians about the potential role of history and social cohesion were tarred by a sense of what had happened in Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany, so that spokesmen for the profession like Oakeshott, Galbraith, and perhaps above all Elton, were at one in condemning what Oakeshott called the chief undefeated enemy of history. And by that he meant the notion that history has practical value or practical enlightenment. It's become much more apparent in the last decade or so that history as political rhetoric or social cohesion has a positive spin, that it shouldn't be seen as the inevitable handmaiden of totalitarianism. It can validate, and it does validate, values of which we approve. And above all, as we've seen in the last few years, the values of multiculturalism and the idea that history should sustain certain memories which we as a society think that it is morally essential that we remain conscious of, such as the Holocaust or the slave trade. We are, of course, in this society a world away from that totalitarian culture that alarmed Galbraith and Elton so much. But it's still the case that political correctness of one kind or another may displace critical thinking. History seems to remain the servant of political masters, whose agenda is constantly changing and is often riven with contradictions which make its delivery in terms of public history or school history extremely problematic. My concern really is with a third way of answering this question, which is not so prominent in the public debates about the matter. And that is to say that history matters because the ability to think historically is what matters. The ability to think historically is the sort of phrase that we might toss around amongst ourselves as what defines our discipline. And I want to make it plain that I'm not advocating here for one moment that the professionalism of historians as such is what has a social or cultural value. But what I am arguing is that the ability to think historically, to some degree, is a resource for citizens. Recognizing where we stand in the flow of time, knowing the possibilities disclosed by the record of the past, being able to distinguish between what is transient in our present circumstances and what is enduring, and understanding the difference between the valid use of analogy and the invalid or naive use of analogy. These aspects of historical thinking are what are in very short supply. They're what were defined usefully, I think, by the American cultural historian Carl Schorska as thinking with history. different from thinking about history, which is what all of us do 90% of the time, and what we're not necessarily thinking with history. What might that mean in practice? Well, I think it means, first of all, being prepared as historians to stand up and demolish or counter myths about the past. Take, for example, the myth which is current in advanced development circles, that the way in which underdeveloped countries become developed and industrialized is through espousing wholeheartedly a policy of free trade. Despite the fact that every single one of the major industrial countries in the world became industrialized and urbanized through a policy of protection. And the double standard that's involved there is one that we might have moral views about, but if we can support those moral views with hard historical evidence, which is in this case very easy to do, then I think we should do so. There's also the need in many instances in our society to, as historians, to plug total gaps in historical knowledge. That's to say, aspects of public affairs where people are required to have a view, to reflect upon some issue about which they have no historical perspective whatever. Essentially because the problem, whatever it may be, is one that has, as it were, come onto the radar screen relatively recently. The point when I became most acutely aware of that scenario was in 2003, at the time of the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq. And what one found then was that in the media, including television, press, there was virtually no mention of the history of Iraq before Saddam Hussein. The only historical reference point was a very unhelpful analogy with Adolf Hitler. What was lacking in particular was any mention, let alone analysis, of the previous British colonial occupation of Iraq between 1914 and 1934, an occupation which revealed a number of very relevant considerations. First of all, that oil was even then a significant element in the British strategy, and it was never acknowledged publicly at the time. Secondly, that the British occupation was it encountered hostility on a routine basis, ranging from refusal to pay tax on the one hand to outright rebellion on the other, and met by the application of RAF bombing power that was in fact a dry run for the Second World War. And thirdly, that the British could only maintain their power in Iraq by ruling through a puppet Iraqi regime which was supported by British arms in the background. Now, this is an easy game to play in retrospect, to point out the analogies, to point out the repetitions in the past. The point I want to make is not that the British public and the historians who might have been addressing them should have said, this is what is going to happen, but merely to draw their attention to the fact that this was a possible scenario and to take seriously outcomes of the invasion, which, frankly, in 2003, were not being taken seriously. 1 minute is exactly right, sure. What I'm referring to in these remarks is not so much an academic deficit as a democratic deficit. A deficit that I think we as a profession are somewhat coy about, somewhat overcautious about identifying and about addressing in public. In The Guardian in January this year, the historian Blair Warden, in the course of an article about the anniversary of Charles I's execution, said, "Public life has never been less historically conscious or informed than it is today." In other words, he was regretting that lack of historical sense. But he volunteered no step that historians as such could take. He was, as it were, lamenting the inadequacies of the media. And that, I think, is not an adequate response in this situation. It's a response which I think this association has a role to play which was, in fact, anticipated when the association was founded in 1906, led by A.F. Pollard, who said that the function of the association and its organ, History, was, and I quote, "to test modern experiment by historical experience." I think that's a good enough motto for us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Claire Fox.
It's often said that history is vital to fully understand the present and the future. I actually agree with a lot of John's latter points there about the importance of historical thinking and its absence today. But I would like to point out that a familiarity with history is no guarantee of understanding the present. A few weeks ago, I was on Question Time with David Starkey, and one of the questions was about the G20 demonstration, and they took him first. And he basically said that the behaviour of the police on that demonstration was unprecedented historically, unprecedented in terms of viciousness. Never had the police been seen to be so brutal and so on. And then they came to me and I had to say, David, you're being historically illiterate. And which he was, because never mind any books that one might have read, I've been at the end of too many policemen's truncheons on too many demonstrations to know that actually the policing of the G20 was relatively mild. A.C. Grayling wrote a brilliant book recently on the history of the rights of rights and freedom, and he explained at an event that he spoke at that I was involved in that he wrote the book very much as a historical reminder of how liberty had been won, and he felt that the reason why civil liberties were being taken away was very much because people didn't know the history of how those civil liberties had been gained. But I think that's actually misguided. I've subsequently heard that Jackie Smith has read the book. I don't think that reading the book will make our politicians any less, any more illiberal, or you know what I'm trying to say, than they already are. You can be fully familiar with the history and still be authoritarian in instinct. So I want to look at in this really not what makes history vital, but why we're asking the question itself, because it's very much a question of the moment. I think that people at the moment in the history world, particularly in academic history, which is what I'm going to concentrate on, and more broadly in the arts and humanities, feel incredibly defensive about the need to justify themselves outside their own terms and to constantly say, yes, we're vital, yes, we're vital. Asking the question, is history vital? It's very rare to get anyone to reply with something that's intrinsic to the discipline itself. There's always an attempt at explaining the vitalness through their useful or ulterior extrinsic purposes. You see, in a way, I don't think history is vital at all. It's a subject that I would like every young person in the country to have access to, because as part of education and liberal arts education, which I'm a supporter of, it's all about initiating new generations into all that's known and all that there is to know. But that's for its own sake. I simply think it's a good thing for people to know that. But I'm not going to go beyond that. But that approach is considered to be incredibly old-fashioned and dangerously self-indulgent. In a debate I did with John Denham at the Labour Party conference, I tried to mount a defence of scholarship. He looked completely bemused. His main point was that scholarship was indeed old-fashioned, but what was necessary was research that would improve UK PLC and help us compete with the Chinese, and that universities were useful as skills brokerages for students. The debate went on to point out that recent research had shown that many young people and their parents couldn't see any direct relevance to their future careers of a history qualification. The problem was that then a historian in the audience stood up and explained, no, it was useful, and talked about jobs in heritage, museums, archaeology and tourism. And it's led to the unsavoury scramble amongst professors of the most unlikely subjects to try and identify the employability skills. So I'm having a problem with this paper. I sat through one excruciating lecture by a professor of medieval history a few years ago who explained how his subject equipped his students with the cross-disciplinary transferable skills perfectly matched to skills needed in banking, which might, by the way, well explain the banking crisis. But if you think that studying history to students, not as a glorious end in itself, but now as a means to another end, as a kind of credentialising course for job skills, actually it shows me that we're really on the losing side on this argument. Sometimes it feels like history is a subject that dare not speak its name. Apparently it's been rebranded in the primary curriculum as one element of the human social environmental theme. And the Arts and Humanities Research Consultation document, Future Directions for Arts and Humanities Research, discourages, even belittles, quote, curiosity-driven single research work, history PhDs, for those of you not familiar with the jargon, and instead emphasises abandoning the traditional focus of the discipline and specialist knowledge, and instead encourages large-scale collaborative projects. And it points out that those projects should make explicit their outcomes and also note the impact of their findings to society. In other words, and needless to say, it talks about not knowledge, but knowledge transfer. In other words, you get the feeling that history has to always explain itself beyond itself. And I think that that is no wonder that school history feels on the back foot is defensive about its value and its worth. But I think that's a very dangerous place for us to be in. I feel as though school history is sacrificing its soul in order to prove it's vital. It's allowing itself to be conscripted into a range of non-historical, non-educational, politically contentious ends. History is never an end in itself these days. It's always a means to some other politically expedient end. Politicians worry that youth are apathetic and too few of them vote. So history steps forward and says, don't worry, we'll offer our services. We can teach them all about the suffragettes. That'll make them vote. Compulsory citizenship classes are failing to deliver the all-round citizens and the right attitudes the government wanted. So history volunteers, we'll do it better. Alan Johnson, who once was at education, complained in public about the sordid racist bullying of Shilpa Shetty in Big Brother House and looked to schools to tackle the tensions in multi-ethnic Britain. And history replied, don't worry, we'll teach the slave trade. Ed Ball says education needs to sell community cohesion, shared British values, a common sense of identity and belonging, especially post-77. And guess what? It's history there again at the front of the class. Me, sir, we can teach migrant history, the history of immigration, to show how successive waves of immigrants enhance Britain, etc., etc. We'll do whatever you want to prove how useful and vital we are. The real problem with this is that it shows contempt for history as a coherent academic discipline with its own integrity. Despite the complaints of the Hitlerisation of the curriculum, I do think it's a good thing to study the Nazi regime, but not as a black and white morality tale of never again, full of sanctimonious platitudes around the evils of racism. Rather, it should be part of a social discussion on the outcomes of the wider and social forces at play in Europe at that time. Of course, if you think historically it's important to consider the slave trade in the curriculum, then do so, but not in order to preach multiculturalism. Actually, slavery is a far more complex issue than that, and to cripple it with simplicity and political moralism does it and your own subject a disservice. If you go down this road, you're going to reduce history to a flexible resource, open to be manipulated by a range of fashionable causes, advocacy, entrepreneurs and political opportunists who have not got the slightest interest in your subject of history, but are happy to use its brand to gain recognition for their hobby horses and causes and even Keith's new national identity, I'm afraid. And what happens if history fails to deliver on this promise? One of my mates teaches history A-level, and her best three A-level grade students are going in this direction. There's one young man who indeed has become incredibly inspired about political engagement. In fact, he argues all the time with his apathetic peers in the class and says they should go out canvassing in the European elections like he is. He's joined the BNP. There's another young woman who's likely to get an A and going to study history at university, a young British Asian woman, second generation immigrant family from Pakistan. Family is secular Muslim. To her mother's horror, she's donned the hijab and calls for the Islamification of Britain. And then there's another boy, who again is his best student, who is completely disillusioned, nihilistic about politics, thinks there's no point voting, is dropping out and moving to an eco-commune in the Scottish Hills. Now, I don't care what those students are doing, other than his interesting stories, but what we want to ask is, has that history teacher failed? They're going to get A's, but according to the QCA, because, after all, I haven't institutionalised the dispositions and behaviour of multiculturalism and actually have ended up as racist or jihadis or apathetic youth, then maybe the history teacher can be blamed for that. So I think it's dangerous if historians try and deliver the ideal citizens. It's actually dangerous because it's dangerously close to manipulative propagandising. And it's worth noting that some of the world's best-known bad guys are highly educated, cultivated and historically brilliant. It's not your job to churn out politically correct role models. My final point is that I think history advocates are also incredibly defensive about their subject to the young themselves. Today's personalised, pupil-centred world tells the young that history is vital because, not of history, because it's all about you. At the heart of Who Do We Think We Are project, we've heard a lot about today, there's an intellectual endorsement of the infantile and immature narcissism and navel-gazing we associate with the young. Politically, it dangerously focuses on the individual identity and fixed and deterministic and fatalism of who we are but have got no control over. We're victims of history rather than history makers. The constant narrowing of history's brief in this way for the new enthusiasts, whether it's of local history projects or family history projects, which assumes that pupils will only get it if you make it closer to home and familiar, is not only parochial but patronising, and it assumes the young are incapable of going beyond their own backyard. It also abdicates your responsibility as teachers, because surely what makes history so exciting is precisely because it's alien to the young. It's undiscovered, unimagined, worlds that the young can't yet know about. History is indeed a foreign country, and it's an exciting voyage of discovery to find that out for themselves, but you have to help them. So to conclude, The problem with selling history as vital because it's relevant to the young today encourages, to paraphrase George Orwell, bringing the past up to date, and expresses today's unimaginative and ahistoric sensibility that flattens out the difference between historic periods. It leads to poor history because it judges everything that happens today, in the past, by the standards of contemporary society. From this perspective, there's no existential difference between the past and the present, between me now and a medieval peasant. And if we accept that, then history is not only vital, you're signing history's suicide note. I'd say, hold your nerve, history isn't vital, but I think you know it's important for its own sake. Good luck.
That's all right. Well, it's not that one, is it? Well, welcome anyway.
Thank you, Claire. Alison.
I really wish I'd gone first. It's really hard to follow that. There's so much I want to say about what Claire's just said, but maybe we'll pick that up in the debate. I'm going to look at this very much from a school perspective, as I think you would expect. And I wanted to start just to say that the question, why does history matter in schools, why is it vital in schools, the answer to that question obviously depends on your perspective. And it does seem to me that as history teachers, and there's plenty of you here, you have to tread quite a careful path between three main perspectives. That of society at large, if you like, and that would include politicians and professional historians and so on. And then you've got schools, and in particular school leadership teams, who will have very particular answers to the question, why does history matter or why doesn't history matter? And then the third perspective, of course, is the perspective of the children. And it seems to me that you can move towards one of those perspectives and lose sight of another, and it's a very, very difficult and delicate path to tread. So I just wanted to start by saying that, and I think as a community of history educators, we do have to engage with all those perspectives, and I think we ignore any of them at our peril. I want to focus on the perspective of the children. And what I want to do is outline what I would want a pupil reaching the end of year 9, when of course history stops being compulsory, to say if asked the question, what has history meant to you? In what way does it matter to you? In what way has your learning in history been valuable? And for the sake of convenience, I'm going to give this pupil a name, and in keeping with that fictional character in teaching history that some of you will have come across and who now has iconic status, I'm going to call him Jerry. Now, Jerry's just finished 3 years of history at secondary school. He learnt some history at primary school, but unfortunately there wasn't time to do very much at primary school. And this is the first time that Jerry's had specialist teaching. He's had just 1 hour a week, which actually doesn't even work out as an hour a week when you take exams into account and holidays and school trips and school plays. And he isn't allowed to study history at GCSE because school has a policy that if you're not going to get a grade C or above, you can't study it for the exam. This is all based on real examples. But despite all of this, Jerry, bless him, still thinks that history matters. So he's obviously been taught very well. And it matters to Jerry for 6 reasons. I'm going to go through them very quickly. Firstly, it matters to Jerry because it's about people. Jerry's learnt a lot about people in his history lessons. He's learnt about what motivated people in the past, what influenced their successes and failures. He's discovered how incredibly diverse people are in so many ways and how difficult it is to generalise about them. He's begun to understand that people in the past lived in different ways to him, and that difference can lead to intolerance and persecution. He's found examples of when people have been exploited and victimised and have shown courage and inspiration. And he's discovered that it is actually possible to live without a television and a PlayStation. Secondly, history matters to Jerry because, to some extent, it's about him. I can almost feel Claire now getting cross with me. His history lessons have helped Jerry to understand something about who he is. He's found out more about his own family history. He's explored how this fits in with other bigger stories. He now understands the history of his local community much better, how it came to be the way it is. He's come to realise that people in Britain have always been on the move, and he's enjoyed speculating about his own distant ancestry. He and his friends spent a long time debating what a British national costume might look like, based on their understanding of the different elements of the UK and the many different ethnic groups within it. Thirdly, it's helped Jerry make some sense of the news. The American historian John Lewis Gaddis described the study of history as looking in a rearview mirror. If all you do is look backwards, then you'll end up driving into a ditch. But if you keep one eye on the mirror and one eye on the road in front, you'll have a better sense of where you've come from and who else is on the road. Jerry may not understand all he hears on the news yet, but he is beginning to use the past to help explain the present, and is showing some very early signs of realising that even if he doesn't know about particular pasts, present issues do have antecedents. It's not Jerry's word, obviously. And it's sometimes worth knowing what they are. Thirdly, it's made school much more interesting for Jerry. I remember teaching a low-attaining Year 9 class in a boys' comp when I was a beginning teacher. And it was a very small class and very challenging to teach. And I expressed my frustration to the head of department once, claiming that actually, wouldn't it be better for them to have more English lessons so they could be supported in their reading and writing, rather than me trying to teach them about the native peoples of North America? And his response has always stayed with me because he said, "Alison, think what an impoverished education that would be, and think how very dull it would be." I observe a lot of history lessons, and I see teachers making great efforts to engage learners. Taught well, I think we would agree that history has the potential to engage any learner. I do wish, however, that teachers wouldn't always go to such lengths to make history straightforward in an attempt to make it accessible. I think we constantly underestimate the level of thinking that young people are capable of. Some may struggle with literacy, others may find it hard to concentrate or debate. But real engagement often happens when history is made complicated and puzzling. Jerry also enjoys history because it's helped him to win arguments. It's got him thinking in particular kinds of ways. In particular, he's able to challenge a claim on the basis of evidence or lack of evidence. By playing the generalisation game in history lessons, he finds himself noticing when people make generalised claims that oversimplify, whether this is about German antisemitism or the fortunes of Manchester United. There are subtleties in the way that Jerry argues that derive absolutely from his history lessons. And finally, it's helped Jerry get onto the school quiz team. I'm not suggesting for a moment that that's what history teaching should be about, but there is a serious point here. Knowing about past events, people and historical trends is helpful and a serious advantage when it comes to participating in adult society. Imagine the disadvantage of not knowing that there were two world wars, or a Reformation, or a British Empire, or a slave trade, or the list is endless. Knowing about these kinds of things is central to making sense of our physical environment, such as the local church, the canal, the castle, the bomb shelter, and many cultural forms, including film, television, art and literature. A recent article in Teaching History, written by Rosie Sheldrake and Dale Bannon, both from Suffolk, describes a unit of work on migration to Britain, which provides, I think, a perfect example of how Jerry could be helped on his way. The unit is structured around three overarching inquiry questions. The first one is, who do we think we are? Which challenges pupil misconceptions about migration as a recent phenomenon and takes the story back to the Beaker people, Celts, Romans, Angles, Saxons, etc. The second question is, how significant is the Ipswich Caribbean Association, which explores the recent history of Ipswich and evaluates the impact and significance of Caribbean immigration to the town? The third big question is migration myths. How should the story of immigration to Britain after World War II really be told? Which puts Caribbean immigration to Ipswich into a wider context in order to assess typicality and to challenge the way immigration is sometimes reported in the press. And what's fantastic about this is that for Jerry, The lessons are full of people, individuals and groups, and they're full of insights into human behaviour in all its diversity. The lessons are about Jerry, about where he lives, both nationally and locally, about where he came from, about his friends and his family. The lessons help Jerry understand the present and to view media reports and other generalisations with a healthy scepticism. And the lessons engage Jerry through challenging questions, a clear sense of direction and purpose, and a myriad of small stories which so successfully reveals the bigger picture. Finally, the lessons do help Jerry with the school quiz team. Armed as he is with knowledge about movement and settlement, particular episodes in Britain's past ranging from the Norman Conquest, Henry VIII, Queen Anne, Chartist movement, and in-depth knowledge of post-war immigration. I included this example, and I'm almost done, because for me it encapsulates history teaching at its best, incorporating challenge and engagement, big pictures and little stories, thinking historically and tackling issues so pertinent to today. It is a great example of how we can teach history in ways that remain faithful to the discipline, but that also speak very directly to the present. And those are the things that Jerry likes about it. Thank you.